Tonight on Arena, Henrietta McCervey gives us a kind of sequel to Dracula in her new novel, A Talented Man, and we speak to the brand new Laureate na nOg, Áine Ní Chlann. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Henrietta McCervey's fourth novel is set in the London of 1938. It tells the story of a permanently broke, struggling writer called Ellis Spender, who sees the potential to sort his financial problems when he finds himself with a sequel to Bram Stoker's Dracula on his hands. The author of A Talented Man, Henrietta McCervey, joins me now to tell me more. And start out by telling me a little bit more about the wonderfully named Ellis Spender. He has himself a problem in that surname and in the actions that it causes him to do, really, hasn't he, Henrietta?
I'm afraid, yeah, he certainly does, Sean, yeah. And he didn't grow up that way, which I think is why he is so frustrated at being broke, because he's from a big society family who was once very wealthy. His father was a famous society portrait painter who was dead. And the family have sort of fallen on hard times. So he's not used to this life, and he feels that the good life is actually his due, and he will do anything that he can to get his hands on it.
Yeah, and we're in the London of 1938, and your previous novel, I think Violet Hill is the most recent novel you had published, and it had a World War One setting as well as a contemporary setting in it. What brought you to 1938? Was there something specific in that period that was of interest to you?
Well, there was a couple of things. I suppose one is a technical thing, in that in order to write convincingly about Dracula, I really needed Florence Stoker to be dead. Because she was, after Bram Stoker's death in 1912, she just took on his estate and battled everybody and anybody if there was any threat to his estate, or anybody trying to, you know, a breach of copyright, for example, as what happened with Nosferatu. And she died in 1937. So I knew it wouldn't have been convincing if there was a story about a sequel to Dracula set while she was alive, because she would have been all over it. So that was partly that. But also, in the same way with Violet Hill, which starts at the end of the First World War, I'm really interested in that period just before and just after a war, when things are really unsettled. And having looked at the period after the First World War in Violet Hill, I was looking and reading about the late 30s, and even going through newspaper archives of 1938 and even into 1939, the people still didn't really believe what was coming towards them a lot of the time. They just would not. They thought it couldn't possibly happen again. So it's a period of time which we now have a shorthand of just before the Second World War. But of course, if you were living then at the time, you were still in the period after the Great War, and it was never going to happen again. So I was really interested in that idea of how people did or didn't understand those sort of massing forces far away on the horizon that were a threat to them, which of course is the heart of Dracula. So the two things really came together quite well.
Which begs the question, how big a fan are you of Dracula, the original Bram Stoker book? It sounds as if you're quite the fan.
I am quite the fan, but I like gothic literature generally. I mean, I like, you know, vampire stories like Sheridan Le Fanu, who was before Bram Stoker. I do really enjoy that sort of writing. And Dracula's quite a messy beast in a lot of ways. It was very innovative at the time, because it used, I mean, the letter style wasn't particularly new, but it referenced an awful lot of new technology. You know, it has phonographs and, well, things like telegrams, which had been around a while, but it was very contemporary, actually, in what he was trying to do. And I think that's really interesting, looking back at it now, that things that seem antiquated to us were actually really fresh at the time. And of course, that Victorian exploration, that fear of what was happening outside in other territories where you couldn't understand what was going on, and the way it articulates that worry about loss of power and loss of meaning, I find that really interesting.
Yeah, and of course, as you say, it feeds directly in to the situation that would have pertained in 1938, albeit that we can look at it with hindsight. But this idea of, you know, massing forces coming from somewhere else, and particularly from the East, I suppose, that there was an aspect of that. But I don't want to give too much away, but I suppose can you give us a hint or a sense of how it is that Ellis finds himself with a potential sequel to Dracula on his hands? He has a skill, not particularly as a writer or an original writer, does Ellis?
No, unfortunately, yeah. I think he's really just a sort of dilettante writer. It was just something to do to sound good at parties, you know. Yes, but he is a very skilled forger, which we do find out very early on in the book, because he has attempted to forge an insurance policy in order to make some money, and doesn't quite get away with that one, but manages to pull off a couple of other little scams. So while he's sort of building up his confidence in that area, his mother, Virginia, was a very good friend of Florence Stoker, and his family were very good friends of Bram and Florence Stoker. So he has access to their world. And Ellis has an uncle called Freddie Broughton, who has just recently in the story has just hightailed it to New York and then to Hollywood, leaving a lot of debts behind him, which Ellis's poor, long-suffering mother has also had to take on board. But he was a theatrical impresario who did a lot of work in the Lyceum Theatre, which is where Bram Stoker actually worked with Henry Irvine. So they have access to a lot of material that he would have collected from then. You know, there's a lot of theatrical material, diaries, notes, letters. And Bram Stoker was an incredible letter writer. Florence Stoker commented once apparently that he could do 50 good letters a day while he worked at the Lyceum. So it was quite convincing, I think, that there would have been a lot of this material just available. So Ellis is actually able to get his hands on a lot of authentic material. He can come up with a story himself, but everything else he needs to construct around it. So handwriting, the typewriter styles, the, you know, an understanding of how the man worked, he's actually able to access all of that.
Yeah, so the forgery skills means that he can present a book that would have been on the same typewriter, or notes that might have been in a hand that resembles Bram Stoker, and therefore he can say, "Look, it's a sequel to Dracula." You bring up the subject of the Lyceum Theatre there. What was your reaction? Because I'm wondering what stage this book was at when Joseph O'Connor published his book set in the Lyceum Theatre for a large part of it, all around Bram Stoker and his activities there. Did your heart skip a beat when you started to read it?
Do you know, it actually didn't, because it sort of confirmed that it was a really interesting subject. I think was part of it. Now, I did also hope that possibly Joe would start this huge trend for Bram Stoker or Dracula related novels that I could just hop onto. But I was actually nearly finished the book, actually, when I first heard about his one. So, and I really enjoyed it. And they're completely different. Bram Stoker isn't actually a character.
Yeah.
In A Talented Man, you know, he's been dead for over 20 years. But so they are actually very different. But it was really interesting to get that completely different take on who Bram Stoker was.
Yeah, but the Lyceum Theatre for Definite is almost a character in your book. There's no question about
that. Yes, it is. Yeah, yeah, it is. And that's, I mean, I think the historic significance of an old theatre like that, even though it's been remodelled many times, even since when I wrote the book, since the period the book is set.
Yeah.
But it's still, you just know that it would have that sort of character in the same way any old theatre that has people traipsing in and out for, you know, a couple of hundred years every night, and so much energy expended in there. That, you know, I think that makes it a very sort of captivating place. And also because it's such a fixed location, you know, that you can sort of imagine things going wrong behind the scenes and things happening behind the scenes as well.
But Henrietta McCarvey, you did have to do a little bit of pretense, if you like, in that you give us a chapter of the Dracula sequel. How exciting was that? How much of a challenge was that for you to actually, as you do in that chapter, as pretending, obviously it's Ellis that's doing the writing, but it's you that's doing the writing for Ellis. You give us the style of Bram Stoker. It feels like a sequel to Dracula. Have you an itch on you to give us more chapters? Or are there more chapters sitting on the desk at home?
There are. I have more chapters. I wrote way more than I would ever have needed to use, because it was so enjoyable. I mean, it's a style completely different to my own writing style. But it's so energetic and busy, and, you know, words repeat themselves, and it has a real charm and a real pulse to it that I feel I couldn't ever have come up with myself. But having read and I read and I reread Dracula, and then I listened to audiobooks of it as well, because you do, you know, the language does sit with you differently when you hear somebody else speaking it. And that really helped just to get the sort of rhythm of the sentences, which are in some cases very long. It is written in a very different style to the way a lot of people would write now. But yes, I have loads more. The temptation to do a full sequel to Dracula It's quite hard to resist, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm wondering, obviously, as you said, Florence Balscombe, Florence Stoker was very much against anybody doing anything that might infringe on the copyright of Bram Stoker while she was still alive. What about the Bram Stoker and the Florence Stoker, the estate now? I mean, would you consider even saying to them, many chapters do you have? Do you have the bulk of a book sitting there? I mean, obviously, we've had loads of these situations, not least of which was recently Owen Colfer and the sequel to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Again, he was asked to do that. But would you approach them? I wonder, have you thought about that?
Do you know, that hadn't even occurred to me. That's a really good idea. Yeah, because I do. I mean, I actually map, because the chapters I use in A Talented Man are from different, I take a couple of pieces from supposedly different parts of the sequel, which is called The Undead Count. So I did make myself a kind of rough map of what that book was, so that they would feel like natural progressions from one place to the other. And I have an awful lot more than I use because I wrote around all those sections as well. So yeah, that's actually a very good idea. Do I have to give you 10%?
Yeah, at least. Yeah. the book's half written at this stage. You know, the other thing is, and obviously I find myself asking this of lots of authors, lots of artists in recent times, is how when a book is, or a piece of art suddenly is out in the public realm, the time in which it comes out starts to have a different meaning. You do talk about in The Undead Dracula, in that sequel, or The Undead Count, I beg your pardon, in that sequel, there's kind of this sense of this almost a virus coming and floating across the sea to invade the place. Were you surprised by that when you saw it in its reality now, in the situation we find ourselves in?
Do you know, I actually really was, because I had only ever pictured it and written it thinking of like troops massing on borders, you know, across Eastern Europe, and then obviously the vampires or whatever that manifestation would be. And then when I went back, somebody had asked me about this recently, that how, you know, I use the word plague, I use quarantine, you know, there's actually words in there that at the time I had no extra resonance for me. And now going back, there's one, you know, there's an entire sequence about that idea of something, you know, troops massing quite far away, and the sound and the feel and what that is going to be like when that overwhelms you. So, yeah, looking back at that again in the last few weeks, it had quite a different significance, I must say. Yeah.
There was another, I mean, you mentioned Arthur Conan Doyle in the last book, Inviolate Hill, as well. Was he a character within it, or was he just...
He was a bit player, really, but yes, he was definitely
He was there, and now, while Bram Stoker isn't present here, he's a ghost in the background most of the time. I'm just wondering about the choice of title here, however, A Talented Man. Is there a nod in some way towards Patricia Highsmith and the talented Mr. Ripley, or was that at all in your mind?
Yes, there is. Yeah. I think The Talented Mr. Ripley it's an amazing book, and it's so interesting the way she sets up a horrible, horrible character that you really want to succeed. You know, it's so hard to read Ripley and not really want him to get away with everything and it all to go right for him. But he's awful. I mean, he's psychopathic. He's an awful person. And I thought the idea of talent was quite interesting, because that's not a talent necessarily, you know, in the same way that Ellis Bender will do anything he needs to do in order to succeed. But the talented man, really, in the book, in one way, is Bram Stoker. I mean, it's the real person is the talented man. By the time you sort of work through the book, because everything that Ellis creates springs from Dracula. So it springs from this real thing that was created by an incredibly talented man.
He's
just sort of circling around it, trying desperately to be it, but he isn't.
I've no need to ask you how you're getting on in lockdown or what you're going to do, because you're going to run back up to the desk now, I presume, and complete The Undead Count. Get it out there as quickly
as possible.
I might
even have to get a typewriter as well, real authenticity.
In the style of. But how are you finding the lockout situation, or the lockdown, I beg your pardon, the lockdown situation in terms of the writing, Henrietta?
I mean, overall, it's been fine. You know, my family are all healthy. We're all, you know, we can work from home. The kids obviously are off school, which is tricky for all concerned. I certainly find it really hard to write at the moment. So, in fact, actually going back to The Undead Count would probably be a very good place to go, because it's very hard to think of anything contemporary without this feeling. You know, I've been going around, and I'm sure so many people have for the last while, feeling like there's a piano dangling by a wire above your head. You know, there's this sort of massive uncertainty and trepidation all the time. And that's actually quite hard, I find, to get anything to work or do anything creative with. So it'll be very interesting to see, I think, not just for me, but writers and artists in general, what actually will come out of this time.
Well, if you go back to the Undead Count, I'm looking for 20% now. That's Henrietta McCarvey.
My agent will be in touch.
Thanks very much. That's Henrietta McCarvey there speaking to us about her current novel, A Talented Man, which is published by Hachette.